Nero assumed, Nero was quite a character. He was a very cruel man. He, give me an example, sort of. It is in, I don't want to, well, I've only got 5 minutes left. I'm going to, you know, cover Nero. Nero is best known because he persecuted Paul, he beheaded Paul. The one historian remarked, this is how history teaches us, that Nero was the emperor and Paul was a poor, miserable prisoner, and Nero judged, put Paul to death. And now men named their sons Paul and their daughters Nero. And, yeah, it was Nero who and by the way, Nero was the one who, according to Suetonius, well, let me before we get to that, let me take this system back and talk about his coming to the throne. Nero was written that particularly well by Suetonius because Nero was a contemporary of Suetonius. So Nero, remember I said Suetonius wrote late in the first century? Well, Suetonius was writing after the fact for all the other emperors. He was being a historian. But with Nero, Suetonius was writing about his own time periods. They were contemporaries. We also know about Nero from Tacitus and from Pliny the Elder, another reason, also from other Dio Cassius and other sources. There was a poet called Petronius, P-E-T-R-O-N-I-U-S, I thought I'd not bring my pen, Petronius, who was Petronius wrote a book called Satyricon, S-A-T-Y-R-I-C-O-N, S-A-T-Y-R-I-C-O-N, Satyricon. What it was a ribald, rambunctious, immoral piece of doggerel that was written to be read or acted out at one of Nero's Bacchanalian banquets, his orgies. It's very important because it gives us an insight into the profligacy, the immorality, the amoral and immoral atmosphere surrounding Nero's court. Finally, this piece of literature that was written for that. It's a very interesting insight. It's by Petronius, called the Satyricon, S-A-T-Y-R-I-C-O-N. I mention this because this novel, this has been made into a movie by Fellini, the Italian movie maker. And it's still being shown still. But Fellini made a movie based on the Satyricon written by Petronius. Petronius was a sort of court poet of Nero. Gives us insight into what went on in Nero's court. He was born, interesting, Nero was born in A.D. 37 at Antium. Antium, interestingly enough, it's along the coast here, Antium is modern Anzio. Anzio is famous for what? Yeah, Anzio, by the way, is on the coast of France, not here, this coast of France, is in Gaul. And Anzio is the site of one of the most famous, one of the great landings in Europe in World War II. Omaha Beach, and Anzio is one of the most terrible battles ever fought, was fought at Anzio. Well, that's where Nero was born. He was adopted by Claudius, we've already said, because of the influence, the machinations of Agrippina, and he came to power when Claudius was poisoned. He had a perfect education, by the way, and reminiscent of Caligula, the first 5 years of his reign were the golden years. He didn't do too bad. And, you know, Caligula was only 7 months. then he went bad. Nero, was the first 5 years was pretty good reign. He did a lot of good things from their point of view, from a Christian point of view, as a good administrator. Nero is usually viewed by being as being worse than Caligula, because Caligula was cruel, but it's generally conceived that he was insane. Nero was cruel, but he, much like Tiberius, he was even worse than Tiberius. He was coldly sober. He was just cruel, just not mad. Okay? We indicated that he was taught by Seneca, famous Stoic tutor, philosopher. And he eventually, what did he do to Seneca? Forced him to commit suicide. Nero was fond of drama. He always thought himself a great poet. You know, the story is Nero fiddled, played the harp while Rome burned, which is probably not true. But it reflects the fact that Nero always thought himself a great poet. First thing you know that the story was, and it's probably just a story, that when he saw Rome burning, the first thing you think of was to grab a lute or a harp and start singing about the burning of Troy, dedicated to the burning city. He always thought himself a great poet and songwriter, but he was not. Okay, this sort of introduces us to Nero. Our time is up. We'll talk about Nero and the mob.
Emperorship, his rule, his rulingness.
or his being on the throne, I don't know those big words. And until he got tired. Well, but anyway, during his early years, first 5 years, we read this. It gives some insight into the youth of Nero. While still very young, he gave an exceptionally good performance in the Troy game at the circus and earned loud applause. When he reached the age of 11, Claudius adopted him and appointed Annius Seneca, who was already a senator, as his tutor. The following night, the story goes, Seneca dreamed that his pupil was really Caligula, and indeed Nero soon made sense of the dream by getting signs of a naturally cruel heart. See here that information of the young man, Seneca, became his tutor. We don't know how good Nero was in being an artist, being a poet, and that the poet was always, this was lyric poetry, that is, it was sung. But the indications are that he was not all that good. He was applauded because he was of nobility. And we get this later on, but you got the idea in his head, he was an artist. I'm just skipping around now. I'm reading Suetonius, by the way. He had reached the age of 17 when Claudius' death occurred and presented himself in the palace guards that day between the 6th and 7th hours. So he comes to the throne at age 17. Now, that sounds worse than it is. In the ancient world, 17 was much older than it is now. It's interesting that the age, I'm going to give you a little discursus now. I mean, I'm going to go off and study for a couple of minutes. Think of age, you see. We normally think of a man, the Jews conceive of a fellow becoming a man when he reached 30. That is, that he was expected to really take his place in the rule and the leadership of the community, although he became a technical man at the age of 12. But 30 was, by that was pretty mature. That doesn't seem, we think of 45 as being, you know, 45 and 50 is really mature. Man hits his full stride, at least a professional man does today. But for instance, the Middle Ages, do you know that, three-fourths of the population in the Middle Ages was under 14? But most of the people in the Middle Ages that you read about, you know, fought the wars, the kings, and all of them, most of that they did the teenagers in their 20s, by the time they were 30, they were usually dead. Some people didn't, there were a few did that deal, very exceptional. The man got to be 40, he was an old man. And as far as life expectancy was concerned. So it was in the ancient world that they grew up fast. Now, for instance, even in colonial America, in the American colonies, the boy was expected to be a full-grown man to go over all the business, all the responsibilities of man by the time he was 14. So they had to get on with it. And it's interesting that people did grow up earlier. As a matter of fact, this may sound strange, but it's true, that these cultural expectations affect physical development. Do you know that today, teenagers are reaching puberty 2 years earlier on the average than they did back in the 20s. Because it's expected. The little girls, you know, as soon as they get to be 12, they've got to put on eye makeup. And after they're 13, they get in a date. After 13, you know, they got to start dating, and they urge you to grow up, get moving. We cannot allow. There used to be a long period, by the way, when a young lady, for instance, would go through the age, when she was not quite a little girl, but not quite a woman yet, and she would keep her diary, and she would have time to be a tomboy if she wanted to be, to have years to enjoy herself. And in our society, our culture forbids that now. Verboten, as the Germans say. Now, by the time she's 13, she must be well on the way to womanhood. Her looks, physical development, so they do that. Just in the cult, there's been many cases of girls who go into like the Moonies, where sexuality is suppressed, that the girls will actually go physically backwards. They will cease having their periods, they will lose some of the characteristics, and boys as well, they will lose some of the characteristics of manhood as if they're going backwards 2 years. So that but boys are becoming men and girls are becoming women in our society 2 years earlier than the world of 20s, because it's expected. the human body responds. Very strange, isn't it?
That's true.
And you see, very common now for 12-year-old girls to have babies. You don't think so? You just ask the social workers. You tell them 12-year-old, even 11-year-old has a baby, they don't even bat an eye. You realize in 1920, they looked upon as almost a miracle. It was a physical impossibility. Not at all times. Well, I take time to talk about this because we see these people coming to the throne as teenagers, and we think, wow, they just must have been kids. Oh, no, they weren't. You know, see, cultural expectations affect us physically in many ways, and they simply grew up earlier, as we do now. In fact, you understand what I'm saying? Affected by culture. And, one of the reasons the teen years are so hard on boys and girls is that the cultural expectations cause you to develop 2 years ahead of schedule physically, but you're right on schedule emotionally. One of the reasons that teenagers have so much trouble today controlling themselves in areas of sex, in areas of drugs, in areas of just general behavior. Very dangerous, very bad. But at age 17, we find Nero assuming the throne and taking over as a man. He's acclaimed emperor on the palace steps. He was taken in the litter. You know what a litter is? Carry him along. Anyway, he accepted every honor except following the country. Now, he thought he was a little young to be following the country. And so he, later on, it was a good title, at least about was. But he didn't accept that honor, accepted every other honor. He, during these golden years, Seneca writes, Suetonius writes, as a further guarantee of his virtuous intentions, he promised to model his rule the principles laid down by Augustus. It was the long shadow of Augustus. And never missed an opportunity of being generous or merciful or of showing what a good companion he was. He lowered, if he could not abolish, some of the heavier taxes. That's a miracle. That lowers taxes. The only two people in history have ever done is Nero and Jarvis. You all awake today? Next time I'll go lecture in the cemetery. Rome, he presented the commons with 40 gold pieces each, settled annual salaries on distinguished but impoverished senators to the amount of 5,000 gold pieces in some cases, and granted the guards, that is the Praetorian Guards, battalions, a free monthly issue of grain. If asked to sign the usual execution order for a felon, he would sigh, "Oh, how I wish I had never learned to write." He was a guy convicted of a crime, and he has to sign an execution order. He expressed great regret. "I just hate to do this so bad. I wish I'd never learned to write." He changed later on. He seldom anything. He seldom forgot a face, and would greet men of whatever rank by name without a moment's hesitation. Once when the Senate passed a vote of thanks to him, he answered, "Wait until I deserve them." And he allowed even the commons to watch him taking exercise in the campus martius of the football field, and often gave public declamations. Also, he recited his own poems both at home and in the theater. Performance was so delighted everyone that a special thanksgiving was voted him. So he may have been pretty good this year, I don't know, but whether they were just who's going to tell the emperor he's some lousy poet. Nero loves spectacles. Keep in mind that it was expected of the emperor. The emperor had to finance this, by the way, out of his own treasury, which was almost like the national mint. But he had to finance entertainments for the mob. We talked about this already. We see that this was a growing problem. As you had so many, you had a couple 300,000 people in Rome were citizens who had nothing to do. Then you had to provide entertainment for them. The gladiatorial show took place in a wooden theater near the campus martius. And by the way, he built this theater. It was a movable theater, like a amphitheater,
you know,
like oval. It was cut in the middle, so that if they wanted to, they could simply roll it back and have two amphitheaters. So it was like a bowl, and they could, so it was hinged, and one part would move, and both parts would come around, and be like, and so they could become two amphitheaters, and they could get double use out of it. So play on each, like put a play on or some kind of show on each of the two halves, or they could throw them together and have a, like a Super Bowl. Anyway, he did, however, make 400 senators and 609, anyway, now let me get ahead of myself. He built this in less than a year, but no one was allowed to be killed during these combats, not even criminals. Very humane. He did, however, make 400 senators and 600 knights, many of them, the knights were equestrians, many of them rich and respectable, to do battle in the arena. Some had to fight wild beasts and perform various duties about the ring. He staged a naval engagement on an artificial lake of salt water, which had sea monsters swimming in it, the large fish, whales. Also a ballet performance by a certain young Greek whom he presented certificates of Roman citizenship when their show ended. He inaugurated the Neronia, named after himself, of course, a festival of competition in music, gymnastics, and horsemanship, modeled on the Greek ones, and held every 5 years, and simultaneously opened his baths, which had a gymnasium attached, and provided free oil for knights. He pictured himself as a Greek. See, remember I said that the highest ideal to the Romans, as far as culture was concerned, was the Greek ideal. And here Nero goes to the gymnasium and tries to reproduce the Greek way of life, elegance, culture, the gymnasium, the arts. Suetonius is looking ahead now to later on in his reign. After the Great Fire, we'll talk about that in a few minutes, Nero introduced his own style of architecture, building out porches from the fronts of tenements and private houses to serve as firefighting platforms and subsidizing the work himself. He also considered a scheme for extending the city walls for his Ostia and cutting a canal which would allow ships to sail straight to Rome. The Greeks had done this, to build a wall from Athens down to the coast. And he thought he would try this, build a wall from Rome down to Ostia, which was the mouth of the Tiber River. He didn't get it done. He also proposed cutting a canal up the coast as far as Rome, so ships could sail right to Rome itself. We didn't get that done either. Also, if you ever go to Corinth, you'll see the remains of some of Nero's work where he tried to cut there is a canal cut across the isthmus there at Corinth. And Nero didn't get it done, but he worked on it. And this is looking ahead too, but one of his primary sources of labor was the Jews who were prisoners of war taken during the Jewish revolt, the fall of Jerusalem, AD 70, and the fall of Masada, AD 72. They looked at Masada, like, for instance, slides. Well, some of those taken prisoner at that war, but not the Masada, because they all killed themselves, but during that war, and he used to try to dig this canal across the Isthmus of Corinth. So he had the grandiose scheme as a builder. Suetonius mentions punishments were also inflicted on the Christians, a sect professing a new and mischievous religious belief. Suetonius is complimenting Nero, trying to get rid of this little Christian, those heathen Christians. He ended the license of the freedom of charioteers to run through the streets and swindle and rob everybody and run over them. Anyway, various other reforms he tried. Appearances of Rome meant so much to Nero that he held the Neronia again before the required 5 years elapsed. He couldn't wait 5 years, so he held it before then. When the crowd clamored to hear his heavenly voice, he answered that he would perform in the palace guards later if everyone really wanted to hear him. If you must hear me, I'll perform later. When the guards on duty seconded the appeal, he delightedly agreed to oblige them. He wasted no time in getting his name entered on the list of competing lyre players and dropped his ticket into the urn with the others. Guards, colonels carried his lyre as he went up to play, and a group of military tribunes and close friends accompanied him. So he goes up and he wins the prize year after year. They would beg Nero to sing when the meal was over, after a banquet. They would applaud his performance to the echo, which made him announce The Greeks alone are worthy of my genius. They really listen to music. But after a while, this got tired. So he, in other words, he was making up songs or lyric poetry. He got that songs that were poems that were sung, and he was from the lyre. Chet Atkins, he wasn't. And so after a while, they would praise him, and he took it. He's like a preacher, you know, a preacher. Guys walk out of the service, and a little lady comes up and says, "The best sermon I've ever heard. That was really a good sermon." Y'all believe that? The biggest fool ever came down the pike. She's just being nice. She said, "Go." No, that's not the best sermon she's ever heard. Odds are against it.
Maybe one of the best.
Yeah, if I believe all nice things, people say, "Man, I must be by far.
Everybody likes it.
I must be by far." Yeah. He doesn't think people are very nice. Forgive me, generous. Especially for the emperor. And so,
I just wondered, did you say that what comes from the emperor is the same?
Yes. Well, anyway, sometimes you do preach a real good sermon. Best preacher, no, 1 out of 10 ain't bad. Anyway, he was kind of like a preacher. Honestly, he was kind of like a preacher, you know, and they paid him compliments. And he took him to heart. He said, "Well, I'm not sure he'll be that good." So he just put on, he had the neuronia held, you know, more often than every 5 years, and every gossip I had. See, they felt called, the way to stay in his good graces was to ask him to sing. So they'd ask him to sing. And he, being the egotist that he was, decided this is because he really was a poetic genius. But then Suetonius lowers the boom. He said, he held it more often, and we get in the theater and start reciting. No one was allowed to leave the theater during his recitals. However, pressing the reason, the gates were kept barred. The reed of women in the audience giving birth. And of men being so bored with the music and the applause, they furtively dropped down from behind the wall to go over the side, over the hill, or sham dead were carried away for burial. The guy said, "Hands got everything. I'll fall dead. You two carry me out." Dead body coming through. That's the only way to get out.
I don't think he's exaggerating.
Well, I don't know. It's hard to say. Probably not. He would go on for hours. So the next time you're preaching away, somebody, one person falls dead, the other two carry him out, you probably preach too long. If somebody gives birth to a baby, time to get to thirdly. And the junior. Yeah. That's your key to get to thirdly and start telling the story about the little boy who's another time. And he thought himself a great athlete. He entered the Olympic Games, the chariots racing, and on one occasion he fell out of his chariot and had to be helped back in. Of course, the rest of them went off and left him. And he had to be helped back in, and even then he couldn't finish the race, but nevertheless he received the prize as the winner. And his name went on the list of official winners, an official Olympic winner. As soon as he died, they chiseled his name off. Because he hadn't won anything. And by the way, this happened before Paul wrote. And I think Paul had this in mind when he wrote to Timothy. Any man who competes in the games must do so lawfully. And the whole world was laughing about how Nero had thought himself a great winner, but he cheated as soon as he was dead. But he was still alive when Paul wrote that, of course. The whole world was chuckling very quietly about Nero's athletic prowess, a great charioteer. Paul says, "Now we know anybody who beats the game test is so lawful. He don't keep the rules, let it count." Well, he says, but Nero began to go bad then, and now we're into that period of his life. As soon as the night fell, he would snatch a hat or a cap and make the round of the tavern to prowl the streets in search of mischief. Not always innocent mischief, either. Just Suetonius, his definition of innocent was pretty broad. Because one of his games was to attack me on their way home from dinner, stab them if they offered resistance, and drop their bodies down the sewers. You know, just for the fun of it. He would also break into shops, afterwards opening a miniature market at the palace with the stolen goods, dividing up into lots, ousting them himself, and squandering the proceeds. Go out at night, rob from shops, and sell at the palace the next morning. Of course, during these escapades, he often risked being blinded or killed. Once he was beaten almost to death by a senator whose wife he had molested, which taught him never to go out after dark unless an escort of senior officers was following him at a discreet distance. He learned that he got hold of the wrong fella or attacked the senator's wife in the dark, and he almost got beat to death. So he claimed to have saved his following at a discreet distance. Gradually, Nero's vices gained the upper hand. He no longer tried to laugh them off or hide or deny them, but turned quite brazen. And we find the transition. His feast now lasted from noon till midnight. I mean, when he went out to lunch, he wouldn't go back into the next day. With an occasional break for diving into a warm bath, or if it were summer, into snow-cooled water. Sometimes he would drain the artificial lake in the campus marshes of the other in the circus and hold public dinner parties there, including prostitutes and dancing girls from all over the city among his guests. Whenever he floated down the Tiber to Ostia, that's to the mountain Tiber, or cruised past Bia, he had a row of temporary brothels erected along the shore, where a number of noble women pretending to be madams stood waiting to solicit his custom. He also forced friends to provide him with dinners. One of them spent 40,000 gold pieces on a turban party, and another even more on a rose banquet. Not satisfied with seducing freeborn boys and married women, Nero raped the Vestal Virgin Rubria. He nearly contrived to marry the freed woman Acte by persuading some friends of consular rank to swear falsely that she came of royal stock. Having tried to turn the boy's spores into a girl by castration, he went through a wedding ceremony with him, dowry, bridal veil, and all, which the whole court attended, and brought him home and treated him as a wife. So he married officially, an official marriage ceremony, and married a young man. He dressed for us in fine clothes normally worn by an empress, took him into his own litter, not only to every Greek aziz, that's a court session, and fair, but actually to the street of images at Rome, kissing him amorously now and then. A rather amusing joke is still going around. See, Suetonius was contemporary. There was the joke. The world would have been a happier place if Nero's father, Domitius, married that sort of wife.
He's a young man. How old is he?
Oh, he's probably 25 now. You mean this boy?
Yeah.
About 12.
Yeah, 13.
The passion he felt for his mother, Agrippina, was notorious. But her enemies would not let him consummate it, fearing that if he did, she would become even more powerful and ruthless than hitherto. So he found a new mistress. That is, Suetonius is accusing him of incest. He found a new mistress who was said to be her spitting image. Some say he did, in fact, commit incest with Agrippina every time they rode in the same litter. Nero practiced every kind of obscenity and last invented a novel game. He was released from a den dressed in the skin of the wild animals. And, well, he felt he was reading anyway. He was very open perversion, sexual perversion of all kinds. Claudius was the first victim of his murderous career, because though Nero may not have been actually responsible for the poisoning of his adoptive father, he knew all about it. This Suetonius liked Nero. As he later admitted Suetonius said, this is how we know that Nero knew what his mother was doing and was in on it. As he later admitted by appreciatively quoting a Greek proverb which calls mushrooms the food of the gods. As I said before, Claudius ate them and became one. Then he tried to poison Britannicus. Now, Britannicus would have been emperor if Nero, anything happened to Nero. We're looking at Herod. You see, if there was a pretender to the throne, if there was somebody that the enemies could put up as a legitimate heir to the throne, then they would have occasion to kill Nero. If they didn't have anybody they could put up, then it was sort of futile to kill the existing emperor. And so they tried to get rid of these potential heirs, and Britannicus was one, and so he had him poisoned. He said he tried to poison Britannicus, being not really jealous of his voice, which was far more musical than his own. Suetonius says he got a singer. But afraid that the common people might be less attached to Claudius' adopted son than to his real one. The drug came from an expert poisoner named Locusta. There's Locusta again. And when its action was not so rapid as he expected, the effect was violently laxity. It made me sick, but that's about it. He called for her, complaining that she had given him medicine instead of poison. Britannicus, well, he got out of this poison was a laxity, and he felt better. And so Nero said, that wasn't poison, that was medicine. You know, all you gave him was milk of magnesia or something. He said. So you think Locusta explained she had reduced the dose to make the crime less obvious. Oh ho, he said, so you think I'm afraid of the Julian law against poisoning? Then he led Locusta into his bedroom and stood over her while she concocted the fastest working poison in her pharmacopoeia. This he administered to a kid as a goat, but when it took 5 hours to die, he made her boil down the brew again. You know, condense it. He tried it on a pig, who died on the spot. That night at dinner, what remained, he poured it to Britannicus' cup. He gave it to the pig Paul, and said, that's what I want. So he takes it with him to the banquet that night, and he pours it, he slips Britannicus a Mickey. Britannicus dropped dead at the very first taste. But Nero lyingly assured the guest the poor boy, quote, had long been subject to these epileptic seizures. Oh, he just got to know, so that he's not dead. And anyway, so much for this kind of guy he was. Then, there's one of the most absurd, if not humorous, events of history, when Nero decides he's tired of his nagging mother, Agrippina, saw herself as the power behind the throne, and she really was in many ways, so he decided to get rid of Agrippina. He may have had something of a lover's quarrel with her, since he had this kind of relationship with her. In the end, her threats and violent behavior terrified him into deciding that she must die. He tried to poison her 3 times, but she had always taken the antidote in advance. The poison was very common, so she, before she went to eat, she'd take an antidote and enjoy herself. So he rigged up a machine in the ceiling of her bedroom, which would dislodge the panels and drop them on her while she slept. However, someone gave the secret away. Then he had a collapsible cabin boat design, which would either sink or fall in on top of her. Under pretense of a reconciliation, he sent the most friendly note inviting her to celebrate the feast of Minerva with him in Bia. And on her arrival, that's not the day, made one of his captains stage an accidental collision with the galley in which she had sailed. Then he protracted the feast until a late hour, when at last she said, I really must get back. He offered her this collapsible boat instead of the damaged galley. And he wrecked her boat, he said, and give her this. I've got a nice boat for you. Nero was in a very happy mood as he led Agrippina down to the quay, even kissed her before she stepped aboard. He sat up all night, tender hooks of anxiety, waiting for the news of her death. At dawn, Lucius Agrimus, her freedman, entered Joppa to report that although the ship had foundered, his mother had swum to safety. He's glad to hear that even though the ship sank, it's a collapsible boat, your mother had swum to safety. So he had no fears on her account. For want of a better plan, Nero ordered one of his men to drop a dagger surreptitiously beside the Agrimus, whom he arrested at once on a charge of attempted murder. After this, he arranged for Agrippina to be killed, and made it seem as if she had sent Agrippina to assassinate him, but committed suicide on hearing of the plot. As you read this name, so this freedman that came from Agrippina, he had planted a dagger on him, and then had him arrested and killed, and then had his mother killed, and the story told was that she had sent this freedman to kill him, and Nero had caught him, and when she heard about it, she killed herself. Very elaborate story.
Columbo would have never fallen down. But he wasn't around then. He's like Italian. And other more gruesome details are supplied by reliable authorities. It appears that Nero rushed off to examine Agrippina's corpse, handling her legs and arms critically, and between drinks, discussing their good and bad points. Yeah. He's discussing her corpse. And pretty nice little woman that was back here and there. She's dead. She's drinking. Though encouraged by the congratulations which poured in from the army, the Senate, and the people, they were glad to be rid of her. He was never thereafter able to free his conscience from the guilt of his crime. Y'all, and by the way, this drove Nero in a way, in a sense, mad. You see, for the Romans, the worst crime that you could commit was murdering your parents, called parricide. They said there's always something beneath everybody. Well, that was what was beneath. There was, in fact, nothing but hurt his conscience. I mean, he would just go out and murder men for sport. If a man put his children to death, under certain circumstances, that was not looked upon, especially the baby. They could expose babies, put them out to die. A Roman father to ride a death over his son. It was not really bad at all. It was often considered justified to put your children to death, even. Brothers and sisters to death. Fair enough. But not your parents. No matter what. And it's a strange thing, you see, the effect of raising and rearing, cultural upbringing, that Nero never forgive himself for killing his mother, even though she was nothing to write home about. And Rome never forgave him for that, really. Later on, it was brought up to him all the rest of his life. Well, this is something interesting. Anyway, Suetonius says, after this, nothing could restrain Nero from murdering anyone he pleased, on whatever pretense. So he became very bloodthirsty. And he accuses Nero of setting the fire of Rome. It's not certain by historians whether Nero actually set the fire himself, because ancient cities burned down with great regularity. These were ramshackle fire traps, and they had open fires from the second, third, and fourth floors of these apartments. Insulae, they were called, usually apartments. And so, probably wouldn't have had to set the fire. But maybe he did. But he's accused of it by Suetonius. Nobody could get away with anything with Nero except the poets. It is strange how amazingly tolerant Nero seemed to be of the insults that everyone cast at him, particularly in the form of Greek or in Latin lampoons, as on the stage. Here are two examples of verses posted on city walls. This is a graffiti. Now we get a little bit of graffiti printed on the middle of the night, somebody scroll something. Alcmaeon, Orestes, and Nero are brothers. Why? Because all of them murdered their mothers. Here's something very interesting. You ready for this? This was either sung on the stage or written on the walls. This is a doggo that was going around. Now it's anglicized, so it rhymes, so it's a rough translation. Count the numerical values of the letter in Nero's name. And murdered his own mother, you will find their son is the same. Those who take my biblical, or okay, what does that mean? Count the letter in his name. They take the letters in Nero's name, give them their numerical value. Of course, you all know the ancient languages, the numbers were also letters. Letters were also numbers. And you take the word, the phrase, murdered his own mother, and you add it up, comes out the same. Does that sound like anything? Count the numerical values of the letters in Nero's name. If he murdered his own mother, you'll find their son is the same. This is an interesting way they look and thought. Well, by the way, you find a reflection of this kind of thinking in the book of Revelation. The number of the beast is what?
66.
six. And it was not three Arabic sixes, you see, you know, on the side of a bus in Israel or some legal document in Russia or something like that. Well, that was stupidity. It was simply that you took the, he was identifying, you add up his name, you comes up to 666.
Yeah.
Well, who's just on the beach?
I heard somebody say a few years ago that Henry Kissinger's name could be added up that way.
I kind of wrote the number of the beast 666, even though Hal Lindsey is historically an ignoramus, he could understand exactly what was meant in modern prophecy. Those people understood exactly what it meant. That's very common. Well, anyway, let me read about the death of Nero, then the death of the Christians, that'll be all of our time. Nero, finally, Galba, well, anyway, I don't have time to get this, but what Nero fell upon, the army did away with him. There were a number of military reverses, and there was popular resentment. There was this, much kind of like what's going on in Iran now, a little bit. That is, finally, people couldn't take it anymore. And he realized that the army was going to get him, that he was done for, his enemies. And so the armies were in revolt. We read, when a dispatch bringing the news that the other armies too had revolted, was brought to him at dinner, he tore it up, pushed what news that the army he called was going to protect him and turned against him. He tore it up, and he made Locusta give him some poison. She put in a golden box, just in case. Hill, you know, like on that. James Bond, you know, give him a pill and take it last night. Well, then he couldn't quite bring himself to it. He tried to persuade some of his officers to flee with him, but they said no. And he said, is it so terrible a thing to die? Which is a famous Virgilian, Virgil's, one of his great lines, as when Virgil recited on the stage, so the stage flood line. Last thing to be or not to be, you know, this is such a terrible thing to die. They thought so, so they didn't go with him. He had no idea what to do. And he's running around like a chicken with his head off, trying to get nobody would help him. Finally, some of his staff even stole his bed linen and took the box of poison. They raided the domestic help who hated him, feared him. As soon as they heard that he was done for, they took everything they could get a hold of, and they could carry him into the hills. And he says, what? Have I been neither friends nor enemies left? Because he was trying to find somebody, he was trying to find one of the trained gladiators to come in and do him in, a professional executioner, to kill him painlessly. He couldn't even find anybody to kill him. You're in bad shape if you can't even find anybody to kill you. And so he said, don't I have any either friends or enemies left? So finally he decided to head for it, head for the hills. Heading out of town on a horse, and he ends up with a slave, some servants, in a slave's house, slave's room, on a slave's bed, and and they're coming after him. He realized that they found him and they're going to do him in. And so he has his grave dug, and the wood collected so that they would burn his body, because they found that they were going to put him to death in the ancient style, which would be to strip him of his clothes, put his head through a forked stick, and beat him to death. He wasn't too enthused about that idea, so he decided suicide for the death of him. He could not bring himself to commit suicide. As his last minutes approach, as one of the great lines in history, as his last minutes approach, he ripped in heaven his servant still with him, preparing his grave where his body's going to be burned, ready for his suicide. He says, "Dead, and so great an artist." He said, the real tragedy of this thing is the stage is going to lose such a great artist. That's what's bad. Anyway, so Nero, when they come and get him, his slave, interestingly enough, who's named Epaphroditus, same name as Paul's man, Paul, let's say, he stabbed himself in the throat. And, so that was the end of Nero. What did Nero look like? Here's Suetonius singing. Hide, yes.
The guard, the army. So the army had turned against him. So the guard who killed Caligula.
His slave stabbed himself.
His slave helped him stab himself. You're all together now. One, two, three. That's off the throat. What did he look like? Height, average. Body, pustular and malodorous. That is kind of stinky. Hair, light blonde. That style of hair he shows, way wearing his hair there, is the Greek style. He admired the Greeks. That's taken from the statue. Hair, light blonde. Interestingly enough, he was Italian, light blonde. Features, pretty, rather than handsome. Eyes, dullish blue. So he told me he didn't like it.
So he doesn't get credit for much.
Neck, squat. Belly, protuberance. Legs, spindling. Now, whether he actually looked that bad or not, but Tony's supposed to have to remember being in his. And if he lived the kind of life he did, he probably looked just like that. However, he says his health was amazingly good. For all his extravagant indulgence, he had only 3 illnesses in 14 years. None of them serious enough to stop him from drinking wine or breaking any other regular habit. He did not take the least trouble to dress, as an emperor should, but always had his hair set in rows of curls when he visited Greece. Let it grow long and hang down his neck. He often gave audiences an unbelted silk dressing gown, slippers, and a scarf. Well, anyway, that's Nero. Now, we're going to Tacitus now, because it is Tacitus who gives us the more detailed account of the persecution of the Christians. Tacitus also, in other words, Suetonius just accuses Nero of setting the fire. Tacitus reflects the story went around. He writes, "But all human efforts, all the lavish gifts of the emperor, and all the propitiations of the gods did not banish the sinister belief that the conflagration was the result of an order. That is, whether Nero set the fire or not that destroyed much of Rome. Everyone believed he did." Testing, everyone thought he did. And so he realized that no matter what he did, the rumor went around that he set the fire. So Nero needed a scapegoat, whether he actually set the fire or not, because everybody thought he did. Mainly because when it burned, everybody's, people are dying, losing their home, losing everything their own, becoming destitute. He's saying, "Man, is this great. Man, this gives me an opportunity to really build a new city." He thought it was great. Well, a guy goes around, watching the fire saying hallelujah, you get a little suspicious, don't you? And that's it did. Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of the procurators, Pontius Pilate. And a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out, not only in Judea, the first source of the evils, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular, reflecting the early views the Christians were terrible. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted. Interesting. Are you a Christian? However, some of them may not have been Christians, but people who were accused of it knew there was no need to deny it, so they would report others to save their own skin. So an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind. This is because, why? They call haters of mankind. Well, because the Christians would have nothing to do with Neronian society. They wouldn't go to the games, the spectacles, the nudity, the sex, the cruelty, the death, the blood, they would have nothing to do with it. They did not, that was community life, and they would not participate in it. Therefore, they were haters of mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burned. to serve as nightly illumination when daylight had expired. Nero offered his garden for the spectacle and was exhibiting a show in the circus while he mingled with the people in the dress of a charioteer, stood aloft in a car as a chariot. Hence, even for criminals who deserved extreme and exemplary punishment, there arose a feeling of compassion, for it was not, as it seemed, for the public good, but to glut one man's cruelty that they were being destroyed. Interesting. Tacitus, who was not a Christian, said that they were so hideous what they did to the Christians, burning them alive and lighting, using them as torches to light his gardens, dressing them in the skins of wild beasts and turning dogs in on them. He said it became obvious to everyone that Nero, Tacitus says in effect, he's reflecting the general Roman mood, well, these people are probably guilty, you know, of something. But nobody's guilty of that much. And he said everyone realized, or many realized, Tacitus did anyway, that these people were not, just that this treatment they received did not reflect the nature of their crime. It reflected the nature of Nero's cruelty. This was done simply because to glut his insatiable desire for blood and suffering. And that's why they were treated so. Not they were innocent, he says, but everybody knew. So apparently Tacitus did not buy this idea that they were all the Christians. That must have been wrong. Well, that's what's so fitting on time. Okay, that's the end of our studies on the emperor. Well, in succession is our topic for the day. We'll get through it. First one we look at is that old Herod Antipater. The Herods were Idumeans. Oh, spelling.
A-E-A-N-S. I'll use the
abbreviated spelling. Yeah. The Idumeans, during the period of the Maccabean freedom, had been forcibly converted to Judaism, therefore they were not in Judea, it's down here. Pasture, big loose, there, in Judea. So here I was not really a Jew, but, and original Herod, Antipater, who was the father of Herod the Great, had performed his service, and I don't have time to go into it. What he had done was, he had rescued, in a military expedition, he had rescued Julius Caesar in Egypt. Julius Caesar was about to buy the farm down in Egypt, and Antipater came to his rescue. And so, this established the goodwill of established the Herodian family in the goodwill of Rome. His son, Herod the Great, the greatest Herod of them all, is the one, Herod, y'all with me now? They're Idumeans. Herod Antipater, the father of Herod the Great, had established himself in the good graces of Rome, because in a military expedition, which we don't have time to discuss, he had rescued Julius Caesar from his fat of a fire. And so they were established as client kings under the Romans later on. That is, when Rome was looking for someone to be their client king, puppet king, in Judea or in Palestine, what we call Palestine, the Herods were very much in line for it. Now, this doesn't mean they automatically got it. What they did was they bought it. They were allowed to buy it. It's kind of, to be a king in an area like this was kind of like a franchise. You bought it, you were the king, but you were responsible to the Romans, and you paid taxes. You paid money for it, you collected taxes. And Herod the Great is the Herod of that we read about in the Christmas story. The one who trembled in all Jerusalem with him. Well, no wonder all Jerusalem trembled. Herod
was very, very crude, yes.
Did he name himself Harry the Great?
No, he's called that by historians. Named the distinction from the other Herods. Herod the Great, now, as we move down to it, remember Herod the Great had fought on the side of Antony and Cleopatra. And the famous Actium War, we talked about, they were Antony and Cleopatra fought the forces of Gaius Octavius, who became Augustus, 31 B.C., and Gaius Octavius I became, later called Augustus, became is the Augustus that we studied about. Well, Herod the Great, interesting, he, to kind of make a long story short, over 75, he did this. He fought on the side of Antony and Cleopatra. And as soon as he saw that they were defeated, he simply said to Augustus, "I'm sorry, I supported the wrong side," and he changed sides and they let him. Now they realized, I think, that he was simply, he didn't care too much who won one way or the other as long as he stayed in position. And they thought, well, if they're to have somebody like that, then they depend on. And so they allowed him, Augustus allowed him to change sides, and he went right on under Augustus to be the king. Even though he had originally supported Antony and Cleopatra. There's a story in the Kipling series, Puppet Pooh's Hill. Very interesting reading. I went back into the story, it was a little short story, so back to medieval times. And this Lord of Pevensey, which was the place where if the French were going to invade, the Normans were going to invade the Saxons, they would all come to Pevensey. But anyway, this man found that the main clerk, the one who kept all the records, Donald signed the goodies, the bookkeeper. He was a thief. A traitor. So they exposed him and cut off his line of communication with the enemy, and then let him go right on. They should have hanged him. And asked the Lord of Manor why he didn't hang him. And he said, "Well, it's better to have a traitor who knows the books than a friend who doesn't. They should keep the books straight." And so he just let me right on. So that's part of what Augustus thought. Better to have, some fellow who frankly said, "I'm sorry, I supported the wrong side. It's okay. They're on my side." So Herod, who knew the books, knew the word, went right on. Herod the Great, interesting character. Herod the Great is known for his building. He built, he beautified Jericho when Jesus came. First when we see Zacchaeus, and climbing the sycamore tree at Jericho, New Testament Jericho, which is not the same place, of course, as Old Testament Jericho. The New Testament Jericho was an exceedingly beautiful and rich city, known for its palms, for its beautiful flora and fauna, its flowers and other kind of plants. And it had been beautified by Herod. Later on, he drowned one of his sons there. But they had one of the pools there in Jericho. But he had beautified Caesarea. He had built a city up here on the around the Tiberias on the Dead Sea. He built another city. He built a great tomb for himself. But this area is on this map. But he was a great builder. And of course, he built Masada, the palace of Masada that we've already seen in the slides. And he built, and all during the days of Jesus, he was building, that is, remodeling, beautifying the temple in Jerusalem. Remember, one of the ways we date Jesus, the ministry of Jesus, because when he says destroy this temple in 3 days, I'm building it, they said, well, 26 years have been working on this thing. You're going to tear it down in three? He started about 16 B.C. Started about 22 B.C., but anyway, without going into the years, for about 20 years, roughly, before the birth of Christ, and then he didn't finish it until AD 64. Up to AD 64, he was working on the temple. It was being remodeled. Jesus was talking about all these beautiful ornate stones. You see these on one stone, so we left one another. Then 6 years later, it was destroyed. But for our
roughly 80 years this building project was going on, even after he was long gone. So, by the way, the temple that that Jesus went to is called Herod's Temple, or the second temple, the building called Herod's Temple. It was a great builder. Yes.
They started in 20 BC?
Roughly, about 22, I think, is the exact date.
They told Jesus they've been looking at it 20 and 50
years. No, well, I just had a year, I see what was, I think, right.
Did he inherit it from his father?
What do they say? It's 46 years, that's what it was. What was it?
46 years?
Yeah.
6 years old.
46 years, that would be the 30 plus the 6 minus the 16, that's what it was. 46 years, yeah. I think it's 16 BC, that's not important. But anyway, it was several years before, the number's right. Yeah.
Wasn't his father a great builder too?
Yes. But not as great as Herod the Great. Very cruel. He slaughtered the infants. Remember, he said, "Kill them all in Bethlehem in the area." He killed his own children, killed his own wife a couple times, killed his own son, maybe because they might be used by his enemies to replace him. He was quite cruel. So he was a combination of cruelty, but a great building genius and a great administrator. The kingdom was very prosperous under Herod. And he ruled all this area. All this area here was ruled by Herod. Now, the great, Herod the Great. Now, when he died, and he died in 4 BC, well, that's one of the ways we date the birth of Jesus. Jesus was born somewhere around 6 to 4 BC, by our calendar. And Herod the Great, he had, these are a list of his wives, Doris, Mariamne the Second, Malphasia and Cleopatra of Jerusalem. Not, that's not the famous Cleopatra. Now, from his three, when he died, he willed, as was the captain we've already talked about, you know, the Roman emperors willed the rule. It's kind of like a franchise they passed on to their kids. He divided up the kingdom among Herod, Philip, Herod Antipas, and Herod Archelaus, Philip, and Antipas. Now, this is important to us because y'all see that? These three. Archelaus, this Herod, Philip, and Antipas. Yes.
What year did he die?
4 BC. Herod the Great died in 4 BC. He divided the kingdom between Herod, Philip, Archelaus, and Antipas. Now, this is important because Archelaus received this area up in here. It was called the Tetrarchy of Herod Philip. Archelaus ended up ruling this area in here. Herod Antipas received Galilee, this area up in here, and Archelaus received what is called Judea in New Testament times. Got that? Herod Antipas got Galilee and so Jesus grew up under the rule of Herod Antipas in Galilee. Archelaus got Judea. Now, I'm put plus here because there was more area than that, but what we call it. And Philip got the northeastern Tetrarchy. Harry Phillip was a, now Harry Phillip, so deal with him first, this area up in here. He was a very good king, comparatively speaking. Very kind, wise, comparatively speaking. However, we don't hear much about it because Jesus did not go into that area except on the edges of it. See, so he does not figure in too much in the New Testament record. Herod Antipas was a pretty fair, you know, average Herod here. Herod Antipas. This is, and however, it was Herod Antipas who imprisoned and beheaded John the Baptist. Now, you got this? Imprisoned and beheaded John the Baptist.
Jesus also stood before him.
Yes, Jesus stood before this Herod Antipas. Now, but let me see, tell you, before we get to that, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Okay, let's take this progression. Very complicated, so I'm trying to keep it straight. Herod, before we see Herod the Great dies, and initially he wills these three, he divides his kingdom up in these three areas, these three sons, okay? However, that situation did not last too long because Archelaus, who got Judea, wasn't worth shooting. He was worse than his father. He was wicked, cruel, immoral, poor administrator, and he was in Judea, this area here. So what he did was, Antipas, this is Mark for us, by the way. See this orange here? This is the Tetrarch of Philip. The green, Galilee, and I put the plus, Galilee and Perea was ruled by Antipas, or Antipas, as we call it, and this fuchsia,
whatever it is,
pink, or what is that? was given to Archelaus. I run this map that says Roman province of Judea under Pontius Pilate. Here's what happened. That Archelaus did not keep this section. Because he was so cruel, the Jews petitioned Augustus to replace him. They didn't want him. So Augustus deposed Archelaus from Judea, this area, Samaria, and replaced and placed this area under a Roman governor. There were a series of governors. Of course, Pontius Pilate is the most famous. That's why, now, so that when we come to the period of the gospel, at the end of Jesus' ministry, the beheading of John the Baptist, the trial of Jesus, the crucifixion, here's what we have. We have Herod Antipas, as this one right here. He is the one who has imprisoned and beheaded John the Baptist. John the Baptist was preaching this area. John the Baptist was from Galilee, therefore he had jurisdiction over him. Got that? John the Baptist from Galilee, preaching this area. He had jurisdiction over him. Herod Antipas is ruling in Galilee and Perea. Philip is still ruling up here. But there's a governor over this area now. And he was responsible, by the way, for the legate of Syria here in Damascus. Or Antioch, I'm sorry, was the Damascus in Syria, but Antioch was the capital. But he was, in other words, Pilate was responsible to the legate of Syria, and the legate of Syria was responsible to Rome. But anyway, he was under a Roman governor. That's why we find Jesus being tried before both Pilate. And when Pilate heard what? He sent him to Herod. Heard he was from Galilee. Remember that? Pilate was trying to pass the buck. When he heard he was from Galilee, and Herod was down there for the Passover season within Jerusalem. He didn't normally live down there. He said, "Oh, wow. Oh, you say he's a Galilean?" And so he passed the buck over to Herod because he was from Galilee, and Herod had immediate jurisdiction over Galilee. Can we run that by you again?
Okay. Herod the Great died, divided this up. But Archelaus was such a lousy ruler that the Jews petitioned Rome to replace him, and they did, took away his rule, his client, his franchise, canceled his franchise, as it were, and put this under a governor, made it a senatorial province, under a governor. What is the main deal? We put it under a governor. That's why, the death of Jesus, we have, this is why in the New Testament, we have Herod Antipas here in Jerusalem, in Galilee, having jurisdiction over John the Baptist, beheading John the Baptist. He was the one who had induced Herodias, the wife of Herod Philip, this Herod Philip, not the Tetrarch. He had taken his wife. Remember, John the Baptist said, it's very complicated because the time they got, ever heard the song, I'm my own grandpa? The time they got to do all this, this intermarrying and several wives and several children and then all, it got to be very complicated. But this Herod, are you ready now? Took the wife of this Herod Philip. And what did John the Baptist accuse him of? Slaying his brother's wife. And so he imprisoned and beheaded John the Baptist, and Jesus stood before this Herod, who was not the governor of Judea, but the governor of Galilee and Perea. Now, okay? Now, after Jesus died, shortly after the death of Jesus, Herod Agrippa, remember Herod Agrippa the First, he was a friend of Caligula. Remember I told you we'd get back to Caligula? Remember the story about the golden chains? Herod Agrippa the First was a friend of Caligula. When Caligula came to the throne, Caligula restored to the Herodian family all the whole area, or most of the area, so that Agrippa ended up ruling almost all of the land that had originally been under the control of Herod the Great. Agrippa kind of got it all back together because of his friendship with Caligula. So we find from the birth of Jesus in Judea, we find this under Herod the Great, okay? Shortly afterwards, they took it away from Archelaus, who received it in the will of Herod the Great. So during the Gospels, Judea is under a governor. However, in a period of transition, Herod Agrippa receives it back. Responsible to the governor. That's why Paul stood before not only the Herods, but also Felix, and later on Festus, down in Caesarea, which is where the governor stayed. But they restored it to Herod Agrippa the First. And it was Herod Agrippa the First who beheaded James. See, now we have a Herod who has authority in Jerusalem again. Yes.
Did you say give his thoughts with him?
To the governor, still, who was headquartered in Caesarea. Okay, let's look. Remember your chronology I gave you? Dig that out again. This is very complicated. I'm trying to go slow and help you with it. I can't find mine.
Who's the Agrippa in the Bible?
Okay, I'm telling you that. There's two of them. Agrippa, the Agrippa. No, it's not Agrippa. That, I mean. The second Commonwealth chronology. Look. You need to borrow yours. I hit my office. Look at your second Commonwealth chronology. What you see is, you have Caligula, 37 to 41. Okay, it was Caligula who restored this area, Caligula restored Judea to the Herodian family, and the one who was Agrippa. Look over at 44, the martyrdom of James. See, if you look at the martyrdom of James,
we once again find a Herod having authority in Jerusalem, the Jerusalem where James was put to death. This was because by this time Judea had been restored to the Herodian family, but it was Agrippa the First. If you're not thoroughly confused by now, I'm just not doing my job.
Where did Herod Agrippa come from then?
Okay, Herod Agrippa was a son part of the family. He was born, he was the son of Herod the Great, of Aristobulus, who was the son of this Mary Antony and Herod the Great. My own friend. In other words, it was very complicated. He had several wives. Don't worry about it. Until test time.
Didn't work.
Yes, Tom.
Who's the ruler from Rome at this time?
Well, look on your chronology, it'll tell you. Different one. Yeah, Caligula restored then. See, that's why I gave that to you. So it was shuffling about all the time. It's very difficult to straighten out, yes.
So they had like one rule about the election.
Yes. These were client, like franchises. They just.
He made them one.
Yes, Caligula did. He restored it to the Herodian family.
The whole thing?
Not all of it, most of it. He gave Judea and some other areas back to Agrippa. Back to the Herods. It was Agrippa, his friend, who wore the golden chains.
But doing
the other ones. He just deposed them. When Caligula came to the throne, shortly thereafter. Yes.
What happened to
our kidding? Well, he died. He was dead by this time, I think. I'm not sure. I'm just trying to, kind of confuse you, trying to keep it as simple as possible. Mainly, I want you to be able to, I'd like you to trace it, the rule in Judea, because it's so important to the world of the New Testament. That's what this class is about.
Yeah.
Because he had fought, remember Tiberius? Emperor Tiberius was purging everybody, and he had fallen into the disfavor of Tiberius. But as soon as Tiberius died, Caligula took over. Remember that? And he gave Agrippa, his friend, golden chain, and eventually restored, gave Judea back to the Herodian rule. It was Agrippa, yes.
On this chronology, who is Herod Marcellus? Is he the name of Archelaus?
No, Marcellus, that's not Herod Marcellus, there should be a line there. That's Marcellus was one of the procurators, one of the Roman governors. Okay, this was AD 35. See, it's in Judea, see right above there? So this would be Herod Antipas. I'm sorry, it would be Herod. Herod Philip, right, it says it under Herod Philip 34. Yeah. But that's this one up here. So I have. You see, we like, because they were not really kings, they were like administrators. Okay, let's. Yes.
Was Herod the Great the one that was the Herod at the time of Christ that ordered the firstborn killed?
Yes.
And fought for the white man?
You see, it's very confusing because all it says in the New Testament is Herod. But in the New Testament time, those people understood. They didn't have to say which one. So you get Herod, Herod, Herod. Paul says Agrippa, you know, Festus Agrippa. Well, which one? They would have. If just one person would rule until he died, somebody took over, and they all had different names. It would have been very handy, but they didn't do it that way. Yes.
The government put on Judea after they got rid of
Marcellus.
The
should be on the list here. The procurators. I listed Coponius was the first one. I didn't list all of them. They were only ruled for one, two, or 3 years, depending on what arrangement they had made. There was a constant change, but I didn't feel like it was important to list all of them.
What year did Herod Agrippa, the friend of Caligula, come to...
I think about 38. See when Caligula came to the throne? Mm-hmm. Shortly after that. So because of the New Testament, I don't expect you to sort all this out, because it's exceedingly complicated. I just want you to see the main point. Jack?
Is there a decent chart that has...
You can see it?
No.
You can see it in the back?
He was the father of The original was that Father, Mary, the Great.
Yeah, now I can see Mary the Great.
Hey, let me put on the board.
You don't make this much more difficult than it really is. Herod the Great, right? Can you see that?
Yeah.
Well, of course, you're shooting my truck margin. Now, once more with feeling. Herod. Now, I'm not going to get all the minor. I'm going to give you the main point, okay? Herod the Great. Birth of Jesus. Slaughter of the infants. Bethlehem. Christmas story. Bathrobes on the church stage. Three wise men. Got that? Herod the Great. Great builder. Built the Sodom. When he died, he willed to one of his sons called Philip, this area right here, the orange part. It's called the Tetrarchy. I'll just put northeast, okay? This area up here. It's called the Tetrarchy of Herod. Herod Antipas, one of his sons, got Galilee and Perea.
Green.
Everybody say
green.
This was the one. Is this Herod? Because Jesus was from Galilee. Because John the Baptist preached in Perea and was from Galilee, who beheaded John the Baptist before whom Jesus was tried. And the third son, Judea, was given to Archelaus. But he was deposed because of his cruelty and maladministration. I mean, he didn't do his job. And it was put under governors. So, even though this Antipas tried, so Jesus appeared before this governor, sent there by Pilate, this king, sent there by Pilate, because by this time Archelaus had lost his rule. And Jesus was from Galilee. Right?
Right.
Now, this whole area, most of it, was given to Agrippa the first, about 38 AD, about 38, roughly. But Caligula came to the throne. So that Jerusalem is once again under the, this is Judea here. Are y'all with me now? So this is the Herod of the birth of Jesus. This is the Herod of the trial of Jesus, death of John the Baptist. Early in the period covered by the book of Acts, Judea and most of that area goes back to Agrippa because of Caligula. So it is this Herod who beheads James in the book of Acts, early part of the book of Acts. He's king in Judea. Got that? This Herod, Agrippa the First.
If I won't say, wasn't this Archelaus lawsuit from governor?
I don't know. It's very early.
Is this the first?
Shortly after the death of Herod the Great, 2 years. Don't worry about that. Yes.
Only at the first doctorate?
Yes. Well, maybe it would be different.
About 8 years
back. Was Agrippa also a son of Herod the Great?
Yes. Agrippa was a grandson.
Okay.
But he had lots of to say you were a grandson of Herod the Great was not a great distinction. That's like being in Salt Lake City and saying you're an offspring of Brigham Young. The answer is, who isn't? Anyway, Agrippa the First, okay? Now, he died, so it is Agrippa the First, can't see that, it is Agrippa the First who
behest James. However, he dies, and we have another, we have Agrippa II, his son. It is this Herod, Agrippa II, who is addressed by the Apostle Paul. He was almost persuaded. Agrippa. Okay? Same area. So it's very confusing because you have this Herod, the New Testament simply called Herod, except the New Testament calls this Agrippa. You have this Herod in the New Testament. You have this Herod in the New Testament. Philip is mentioned, but this Herod tries to kill Jesus at birth. This Herod puts Jesus on trial.